I would like to address in the final section this evening, this is going to be a short one, I'd like to address the issue of personhood, because in my view, the issue of personhood unites all of the pressing ethical and bioethical issues that are confronting us as a culture. As I was preparing tonight, I was tempted to look at 5, 6, 7, 8, some of the issues up there that Dr. Bernard described, as well as homosexuality, criminal justice, areas in which I've done some work. They all hinge on, do they not? You may perhaps you see it differently. But they seem to hinge on one's view of personhood. And from our perspective, they seem, do they not, to diminish human personhood. Of course, we're jaundiced by our Christian worldview and our understanding of human nature based on the doctrine of creation. Now, in contrast to what I've been pleading up to now, I would ask you, would you please take the first page of your handout, turn it over, most of you have it before you. Three citations there by three very important bioethical thinkers, John Harris, Tom Beecham, and Peter Singer. Singer's name probably is familiar to many of you, the other two perhaps less so. John Harris is a distinguished British bioethicist. He's editor-in-chief of the prestigious Journal of Medical Ethics. He's one of the founding directors of the International Association of Bioethics. He's author of some 15 books. And since 1986, he's the research director of the Center for Social Ethics and Policy at the University of Manchester. That little bit just to say, he's got influence in the UK and in the bioethical sphere. Read what he has to say about the concept of human personhood, and I drew this out of a journal, Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal, which is almost 10 years old, but it certainly is relevant for our day. We all know lots of people. We all know lots of persons. Normally, we use the term persons as a synonym for human beings, people like us. However, we are also familiar with the idea that there are non-human persons, and humans who are not, or may not be, persons or full persons. Human non-persons are humans who are not fully fledged persons. They include zygotes, embryos, individuals with brain dead, anencephalic infants, or individuals in the system. Vegetative state. Wow. Interesting. Consider Tom Beecham's statement here. Beecham is one of two or three eminent American bioethicists. He has been at Georgetown, and he is a professor of philosophy there who, over the last 20 years, has influenced the direction of discussion of bioethical issues, certainly, at least on this side of the pond. If non-humans turn out to possess significantly more advanced capacities than customary human vision, their moral standing would be upgraded to a more human level. However, this possibility remains speculative and may be less important than the thesis that because many humans lack properties of personhood or are less than whole persons, they are thereby rendered equal or inferior in moral standing to some non-humans. If this conclusion is defensible, we'll need to rethink our traditional belief that these unlucky humans cannot be treated in ways we treat relevantly similar non-humans. For example, they might be aggressively used as human research subjects, resources, organs. Lastly, Peter Singer, who in the year 2000 was offered an endowed chair, the university chair in human values, caused some controversy when he arrived, particularly on the part of groups such as disability rights constituencies and whatnot. Probably more controversy was actually from without than from within the university. By the way, he was appointed by the president at that time was Harold Shapiro, who happened to chair President Clinton's Council on Bioethics. Every president has a council, and Bush has appointed people who probably are a lot more conservative and compatible with your and my worldview. But Shapiro chaired the chair under the Clinton administration, and he appointed Peter Singer to the chair at Princeton. Taken in itself, membership of human species is not morally relevant. Whatever criteria, personhood, we choose, we will have to admit that they do not follow precisely the boundary of our own species. They will surely be some non-human animals whose lives, by any standard, are more valuable than the lives of some humans. A chimpanzee, a dog, or a pig, for instance, will have a higher degree of self-awareness and a greater capacity for meaningful relations with others than a severely retarded infant, someone in a state of advanced senility. I'm curious as to how you react to statements by these sorts of authorities. I don't think I'm yanking anything out of context if you went back to that next to the journal. There would be nothing that would suggest that at all. Take note of the language. Go ahead, yes.
Chimpanzees are patrons with a higher degree of self-awareness. People that are not dog lovers, not animal lovers, would dispute that statement. But being an animal lover, I have seen that in action, and I've read stories about good things that animals do when under duress.
There are some behavioral theorists aligned with that. Today, who are studying primates and studying the moral life of primates, and who argue vigorously that the difference between human and primate behavior morally is the difference between lower as opposed to higher stories in it from the same building. The question then is, do we need to distinguish? Obviously, these people like that particular behavior theorist are assuming an evolutionary understanding of development and morality. The question, which will be wholly materialist, the question then arises, what to do with the soulish dimension, what to do with moral progress, what to do with moral issues, what to do with moral improvement. Why be virtuous? It's genetic, programmed. Where are the social philosophers among the primates? Where are the teachers of ethics and political philosophers among the primates? I mean, I'm not trying to be cheeky. I think it's a reasonable question to ask. We're going to class the distinction between human and non-human behavior. We need to ask those questions. That's the most basic level. But that, I mean, we are talking general revelation. But that's where we have to start. At least at the theoretical level. Now, the average person in the pew and the average lay person probably doesn't believe that. But what if 20 years from now, theorists like that, who are, by the way, teaching at schools where you're sending your children, maybe not here, so they're training future leaders, future scientists, future cultural elite, future knowledge elite, those who will be making decisions. Now let's extrapolate 20, 30 years down the line. It seems to me our understanding, our vision of personhood, at least that they're articulating, is critical. Permit me, and I said it before, I'll say it again this evening, to say that most, if not all, of our culture's critical bioethical issues hinge in some way on the question of personhood, from embryonic experimentation and research to abortion and infanticide to the reputed biological factor in homosexuality to genetic enhancement to euthanasia. Suicide. For this reason, then, the ethicist Gilbert Mailander, whose text you're using, You Couldn't Choose a Better, observes, and I quote Mailander, because much of the contemporary bioethical reflection has lost the moral significance of the body, it has in truth lost its very soul. I think Dr. Barnard was saying that with other words earlier. And Mailander, I think, is correct. Whether Peter Singer really is genuine in his statement there that membership in the human species is not morally relevant, that's debatable. I mean, nevertheless, I think he performs us a valuable service by framing the relevant issues as stark and matter-of-factly as he does. Let me, before I close, simply draw an analogy from Aristotle, certainly no theist, but who nonetheless thought a lot about human nature as well as the physical nature. And I'm going to use his illustration of the acorn and the oak tree. Resident within the acorn is all the potential that distinguishes the genus oak. This potential furnishes a sufficient explanation of both the diversity as well as the sameness within the genus, and it offers an adequate description of the nature of the oak. There it is again, the nature. At whatever stage of the oak's development, regardless of where the oak is found on the globe. The description of the oak's fundamental nature has nothing to do with how the oak functions, what it looks like, its size, how large it may eventually grow, or how it might weather the elements. Nor does this understanding of the genus oak vary among Asians, Africans, North Americans, Europeans, Latin Americans, and so forth. Rather, an oak is an oak everywhere, period, precisely because of its essence, its nature. Therefore, we can draw certain conclusions regarding the interrelationship between the acorn and the oak. For example, without the oak tree, the acorn would not exist. The acorn is thus dependent on the oak tree for its existence. Conversely, the oak tree is dependent on the acorn for its existence. I'm sorry, the acorn may or may not grow sufficiently, but this possibility does not bear on its essential nature. The oak tree may or may not grow to the size of other oaks, but this possibility doesn't bear on its essential nature. Therewith, I only want to point out that the genus oak is oak because of its nature. And this is universally the case. That sort of thinking, it seems to me, is rich with implication as we consider human personhood. It guides us on how we approach beginning of life issues, for example, in vitro fertilization, human research, cloning, abortion, or infanticide. Peter Singer has been a strident and vigorous advocate for not only animal rights, perhaps best known for that, but for abortion and infanticide in the case of developmental dilemmas. It guides us regarding life enhancement, about which we heard much earlier tonight, given the explosion of genetic information. And it guides us with regard to end of life. So it seems to me the whole life spectrum is addressed by how we view personhood. Humans possess an intrinsic dignity by Humans possess an intrinsic dignity by virtue of their human nature, by virtue of their creation, by virtue of their membership in the species. Human sanctity and human rights are meaningless apart from the notion of a human inherent dignity. And both religious as well as non-religious people can affirm that, I would argue. Although, obviously, the Christian has a deeper awareness of that for theological reasons. Affirming objective moral truth, truth which all people intuit through the natural law, yields a common moral judgment to protect and dignify human life, regardless of its potential, regardless of its social utility, regardless of its functionality. Given our commitment to the intrinsic dignity of the human person, we are there then, therefore, categorically forbidden from eliminating it. And before his death, one of the great services of John Paul II, through his regular encyclical teaching, was to bring that to mind. The 1995 encyclical, Evangelii Vitae, who translated the Gospel of Life, was very important. For therein, John Paul addressed a sort of seamless garment approach to life issues from beginning to end of life. He argued that there is a continuum from the human embryo to the grave that morally must not be broken. And for that reason, then, in his encyclical, he spoke of crimes against life and attacks on the dignity of life. Compare John Paul's reasoning with this, John Harris again. That's not on your handout. The life cycle of a given individual passes through a number of stages of different moral significance. Sorry if you can't read it back there. This individual will gradually move from being a potential or a free person into an actual person when she becomes capable of valuing her own existence. And if eventually she permanently loses that capacity prior to death, she will have ceased. Those of us who have already buried our parents, or who have wrestled with whether hospice, whether not, living will, and so forth, these are very difficult issues, and they bring out the essence of the argument of personhood so graphically. With John Paul, I think we may insist that there is, in fact, a moral line that connects the human embryo and fetal destruction and fetal tampering and euthanasia and life enhancement and slavery and genocide and totalitarian rule. I would argue there is a moral line that connects all of those. If it is agreed that we never take life at any developmental stage, and regardless of functionality, then intentionally taking life at any point along the life spectrum for any reason will always be wrong. Now, that doesn't address the whole realm of enhancement issues, but you get the point. It is wrong not merely because the Christian Church or the Bible teaches that it's wrong, but because the natural moral law, the law written in the heart, witnesses to its wrongness. I conclude. As it relates to bioethical issues, the Christian community has an important, and I would argue, irreplaceable role to play in raising the questions that the culture prefers not to confront. These questions are important simply because, as was suggested earlier tonight, scientific and biotechnological advance goes on much faster than do our attempts to reflect morally on those advances. That's the way it works. And so it's not about being a Luddite, or sticking our heads in the sand, or being anti-science, but rather it's about reflecting morally on not can we, but the opposite, should we. Why? The Christian community, let me say in closing, should seek to inform moral discourse and cultural conversation wherever it is found. And of all people, it must be Christians, those who redeem, the company of the redeemed, to bring to bear moral principle in the public square. And I know that flies in the face of a lot of what's going on in our churches, where perhaps the main issues are church growth and being seeker friendly. I'm getting cynical there, I didn't finish that statement, but it seems to me in the spirit of James 1:27, though, caring for widows, helpless, fatherless, defenseless, providing health care options, helping them mourn. That seems to be the spirit of Christian charity and our Christian witness. In the years to come, however many or few were granted for the purposes of redemptive cultural engagement, seems to me will doubtless be confronted in increasing ways by dehumanizing tendencies. We've already witnessed that, I think, in the splendid overview earlier tonight. And if we may categorize them, and I think here I'm simply repeating Dr. Bernard, freedoms of a contraceptive society, that would be one major realm, demands for human autonomy, and thirdly, cries for perfection, whether it's bodily or therapeutically, of the human race. I was struck by, who was it, the gentleman who made the comment on criminal justice earlier tonight, I was struck by it. By my experience back in the early to mid-90s working in Washington, already then behavioral theorists were calling for a genetic solutions to the problem of violent and antisocial behavior. And while there's not a majority of criminologists, social theorists, social scientists, and brain researchers who are calling for it, it's gathering steam for reasons that you can intuit tonight. What do you do when antisocial behavior gets out of hand? Well, there are ways of remaking the face of the culture. You can define deviancy downward, as the late Senator Dan Patrick Moynihan argued in the early 90s. Very insightful. Defining deviancy downward to normalize it. Do that. There's a reverse to that, by the way. You criminalize normalcy, like religious faith in the public square. And by the way, this was one of Lewis' great fears. One day, he said, people with religious faith will be branded as insane and threats and menaces to the culture. Now, it may not happen here, but it could very well if that moral consensus dissipates. So I think there are some things, yeah, that are already in motion to cry out for thoughtful cultural engagement. That doesn't mean we have to give up evangelism or church growth. But it does mean that we have to rethink what our witness is going to be in the Christian community. The realm of bioethics is very intimidating for most of us early people. I mean, even people who are full-time delving into it can't stay abreast. I mean, literally stuff is changing every day. If you could be, your job could be on the internet to keep track as the speaker in 2 weeks, Michael Ford will do and does. He does an amazing job. But you still, even if you had that kind of endeavor and time and effort, you couldn't save it. So it's intimidating, but on the other hand, it seems to me it's not just about technology. It's also about reflecting more on what human beings are and what human beings should or should not do. May God give us grace to do that. Thank you very much for your attention this evening after a very long day.